Hello and welcome to Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national. Paul Barclay with you. We take you into the vast expanse of the universe tonight. Or better, Australia's 2011 Nobel laureate, Professor Brian Schmidt, will do just that. In 1998, two teams of astronomers were tracing how the universe had expanded during its long history. They thought they'd find the expansion was slowing down. Instead, they found it was speeding up. This shocking discovery overturned astronomical thinking about the history and the fate of the universe. Now, this expansion of the universe must be caused by something. Astronomers call it dark energy, and it seems to make up more than 70% of the cosmos. But what on earth, if you'll excuse the pun, is it? Professor Brian Schmidt led one of the astronomy teams, and tonight he describes this groundbreaking discovery and explains how astronomers track the history of the universe back more than 13 billion years and what they think its future will be. Brian Schmidt is a laureate fellow at the Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the Australian National University, and he presents the annual Alison Levick Memorial Lecture for the Australian Astronomical Observatory.
So today I'm going to talk about the accelerating universe. And the accelerating universe is a story not related just to myself, but to really 100 years of study of the universe above us. But before we embark on that, I want to start with a tour of the universe, since I realize that not everyone here knows the universe like I do, like the back of my hand. So the first thing I want to make the point of is that the universe is big. And just how big it is, we're going to go through and we're going to take a tour using the speed of light as our ruler. Now, the speed of light is 300,000 kilometers per second, meaning that light travels around the Earth 7.5 times each second. So using that as our guide, let's take a quick tour. So when Neil Armstrong took his one small step, we found out about it 1.5 seconds later here on Earth. It took light 1.5 seconds to make that journey. If we look at the Sun is much bigger than the Earth-Moon system. It's 5 light seconds across. And the reason it appears so small is because it's so far away. It's 8 light minutes in distance. And so if we look further afield to, for example, the edge of the solar system out to Pluto, so Pluto, of course, was demoted as a planet, something I'm afraid I voted against at the meeting, figuring that once a planet, always a planet. But my colleagues didn't side with me, and so Pluto is now given the term dwarf planet, something I'd be offended if I were Pluto by. But Pluto is about 10 light hours away from the Sun. Now, our solar system actually extends well beyond Pluto, literally light years in distance. But if we look up tonight in the skies above Sydney, even in Sydney, you can see the nearest other solar system. That is the star Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years in distance. Now, Alpha Centauri is the brighter of the two pointer stars pointing towards the Southern Cross, and it's almost straight overhead tonight, easily seen. Now, Alpha Centauri is a star not dissimilar to our own Sun. So I want you to think of the size of the universe. Think of Alpha Centauri being a soccer ball. Now, I want you to think of the Sun being another soccer ball. They're twins, essentially. These two stars are about the same size. If I'm standing here with Alpha Centauri in my hand, then the other soccer ball, our Sun, would be located roughly in the middle of the United States, across the Pacific Ocean, with everything in between us, empty space. That is a scale model of our own local environment, the Sun versus Alpha Centauri. And that's particularly remarkable when you think we live in a galaxy of 100 billion stars, the Milky Way. And so we're about 30,000 light years out from the center of this mass of stars. And if you look at the Milky Way from above, it looks like a pinwheel, from the side, like two eggs together. Now, our galaxy is, of course, only one of many in the sky. And if we look at the nearest galaxies, we have two visible here again, but not easily from Sydney, the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds. These are two fuzzy blobs seen especially in the spring from a dark site, and they are satellite galaxies. They're like the moon of our Milky Way, and these objects have about 10 billion and 1 billion stars, respectively. And they're not really large galaxies. The first large galaxy is the Andromeda Spiral, 2 million light years in distance. The Andromeda Spiral, visible from the northern hemisphere, is slightly larger than our own Milky Way. Now, if we go through and map out the cosmos in greater detail, you see not just a few galaxies, but hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them. Here in Australia, they were able to map out the nearest billion light years, and you can see a foam of galaxies filling the sky. Of course, astronomers like to have big toys, and our big toys are telescopes. And these telescopes allow us to look back in time. The bigger the telescope, the further we can see. Here is the deepest image we've been able to take to date, taken with the Hubble Space Telescope, and we're able to look back here 12 billion years into the universe's past. So the universe is huge. But remember, the amount of universe that we can see is finite. And it's finite because we run out of time. If we look back 13.7 billion years, we do not see stars, we do not see galaxies. Instead, we see an image of what we call the cosmic microwave background. We see sound waves rippling around the universe, of which these ripples eventually become thousands upon thousands of galaxies. Here, the universe was a roughly 4,000 degrees in temperature and was made up of hydrogen and helium and not much else. There were no stars and galaxies. And just before this, 380,000 years before this image, we had what we call the Big Bang. All right, so we're done with our tour. Now let's put this all together and see how the universe works. Now, I always say that the beginnings of cosmology, at least from an observational point of view, and that's what I am, I'm an observer, not a theorist, started when we were able to take the light of stars and put them through telescopes, and we were able to first start doing this at the beginning of the 20th century. If you take the light of a star like the sun, you spread out its colors into the colors of the rainbow, what we call a spectrum, then you see a rainbow of colors, but then there are places where there is no light that gets through. And that's because all the elements have a fingerprint of color where they absorb or emit light. And so you can identify things by looking at a star, at a spectrum, and you can see what it's made out of. Helium gets its name because it was discovered in the sun before it was discovered on Earth and was discovered by its distinctive color fingerprint. Now, a person who you probably do not know, Vesto Melvin Slipher, went through and took the light of galaxies, took their spectrum, their rainbow of color, and he noticed that they looked a lot like a star, but there was a difference. The light was stretched. It was stretched redward of what the sun looked like. And he knew that the Doppler shift was a way to interpret this stretching. So we are familiar here on Earth with the Doppler shift, thanks to the police and ambulances that occasionally come towards us. And when, for example, a police car with a siren on comes towards us, the sound waves are compressed, raising the pitch of sound. And as it goes by, well, then, of course, we see the sound waves stretched, lowering the pitch. Now, for light, the same process works, because light is a wave. So if you have a galaxy that's coming towards you, its light waves are compressed, and that raises the pitch of the light, which means makes it bluer. On the other hand, if the galaxy is going away from you, then the light is stretched, making it appear redder. So Slipher was able to interpret the idea that all these galaxies were stretched red, that all of the galaxies were moving away from us. Now, this was quite a conundrum in 1916 when he did this work, because it seemed to indicate we were in a special place in the universe. And since the time of Copernicus, we had figured we should be in a place like every other place in the universe. We should not be a special place. Apparently, we were in a very unpopular place in the universe that everything was going away from. And so that was a big mystery. The mystery was solved by measuring distances. Now, measuring distances in astronomy is not trivial. We cannot just lay a ruler down between us and the nearest galaxy. Instead, we have to rely on how things appear. Fortunately, things appear fainter the further away they are, and they appear smaller the further away they are. And so we can use the brightness of objects, for example, to figure out how far objects are apart. So Newton realized that if you take an object, such as a light bulb, and you see how bright it is, and you have its distance, it appears four times brighter. We call that the inverse square law for light. So Edwin Hubble was able to use this to measure the distances to Slipher's galaxies. And he had access at the time to the largest telescope on the planet Earth, the Hooker 100-inch telescope, located just outside of Los Angeles. And he used those stars and how bright they were to estimate distances. And what he found was the faster that the galaxy was moving away from us, the fainter its stars were. Or in other words, the further away the object was, the faster it was moving. And to show you his data, I have the original publication. And you can see in this chart, we have nearby objects which have brighter stars and distant objects which have fainter stars. And you can see a trend when you move from low redshift or low velocity to higher velocity that you become further away you are, the faster you're moving. And he proclaimed in 1929, he had a very good publicist, Hubble did, that this meant that the universe was expanding. So we don't just believe the universe is expanding solely on Hubble's conclusions. We put that together with a theory. And that theory comes from Einstein. Einstein's theory of gravity. In 1907, Einstein had what he described as his greatest thought. And that thought was that acceleration due to motion and acceleration due to gravity were equivalent. That is, if you were in a box, not knowing what was going on, and you were on the surface of the Earth, you would be accelerated by gravity by 9.8 meters per second squared. Einstein said that if instead you were in space in a rocket and you were accelerated by 9.8 meters per second squared, there is no way to distinguish those two situations. They are equivalent. They are identical. A small thought, but a thought that took Einstein 8.5 years to solve. And when he solved it, he realized that space was curved by gravity, and it allowed him to do something that Newton could never do, which was to solve for cosmology, that is, the universe on its greatest scales. And when he did that work in 1917, he came up with a problem. He found that his solutions to the universe indicated it should be in motion. And since in 1917, that was 12 years before Hubble made his discovery, he did what any good theorist would do. He came up with a fudge factor. And that fudge factor he called the cosmological constant. So the cosmological constant is effectively like adding energy to the fabric of space itself. And it turns out, according to his equations, this energy would cause gravity to push rather than pull. And so by adding this energy to space, he could neutralize the effect of gravity, which was contracting, was pulling on the universe. And he thought he could stabilize the universe. It turns out it doesn't work. Mathematically, it was a mistake. The universe would be unstable regardless of how much of this stuff he added. So, later on in life, he was quoted as saying this was his greatest blunder, because amongst all the other things Einstein did, he could have as well predicted that the universe was in motion, expanding or contracting. All right. With Einstein, we sort of get a different view of the universe than what Slipher and Hubble saw. When you look at a distant object, you're looking back in time, and as the photon, which is a wave, travels through space, its wavelength is traveling through space, which is stretching. And so the photon gets stretched with the expansion of space. So the more that the object and the further that the object is away, the more the photon travels through stretching space, and the photon gets gradually redder and redder due to this creation and expansion of space. So imagine a universe which is expanding. Let's put it in reverse. What happens? Things get closer and closer and closer and closer until everything in the universe is on top of everything else. That is that time of the Big Bang, when everything is on top of everything else. So graphically, if we look at the distance between two galaxies, which are separated by some distance at some time, and we run the universe in reverse, I get a trajectory. And that trajectory is the current expansion rate of the universe, the Hubble constant. You find out that the objects are on top of each other at a specific time. And so that time is the time of the Big Bang. Now, when I was a graduate student, I started my PhD in 1989 at Harvard. I thought trying to figure out how old the universe was would be a really good project. And so that's what I decided to do. 3 years, 11 months, and 4 days later, here is me showing my PhD supervisor my results. I have measured how fast the universe was expanding, and I'm very excited about it. And the number that I found was that the universe was roughly 14 billion years old. Now, I'd like to say I was solely responsible for that result. I was part of a much larger conversation. This was trying to figure out how old the universe was something that started in the 1920s and finished about 2002. And so that the work that really definitively gave us this number was done using the Hubble Space Telescope in a program led by Jeremy Mould and two other people. And Jeremy is the director of Mount Stromlo Observatory who brought me to Australia in the end of 1994. And so when Jeremy and his team announced their result, the number they got was the same within 1% of the number I got. And so Jeremy came into my office and said, "Well done, you can keep your thesis," and gave me a gold star. So when you try to figure out the age of the universe, I've made a small omission. I've made the expansion rate of the universe back in time stay the same back in time. But we know the universe is full of gravity. We are living proof of that. We will pull on the rest of the universe and try to slow it down. Everything in the universe pulls on everything else. And just like a ball that I throw up in the air, that stuff will pull on the object and change the trajectory. And so if the universe is full of gravity, then the trajectory will be different. You will have the universe expanding more quickly in the past and slowing down over time. You will note that if the universe is slowing down, it will not be as old as we think. And indeed, for a certain amount of material, a reasonable amount of material, the universe might well be, instead of 14 billion years old, like I measured, if it slows down enough, it might only be 8 or 9 billion years old. And that's a problem, because we're pretty sure that the universe has stars that are at least 12 billion years old in it. And although we cosmologists are not too fussy about our answers, we do normally like to have the universe older than the things that are in it. If we take this and look forward to the future, there are some interesting consequences. Imagine a universe which isn't slowing down. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger over time. It keeps going to greater and greater extents. It never ends. It is a universe which is infinite into the future. On the other hand, a universe which is slowing down, well, you can imagine if it's slowing down quick enough, it will reach a maximum size, stop, and then go in reverse. So this universe, as does the infinite universe, begin with a Big Bang, but the second universe ends with a Gnab-Gib, which is the Big Bang backwards. So that is an interesting consequence to having a universe which is slowing down. So in review, the slowing down of the universe affects how old we think the universe is. It tells us the ultimate fate of the universe. And it turns out it tells us the shape and weight of the universe. The universe, remember, can be bent by gravity. If you have a heavy universe, then the universe, it turns out, is finite. A universe that is heavy enough to eventually stop and go in reverse and is finite in time is also finite in space. And so this universe wraps onto itself, and it's a universe which is wrapping around on itself in a fourth dimension that's related to time. Now, if you're concerned that you're struggling to visualize how space could bend onto itself, don't worry. I can't visualize that either. And indeed, I've never met a sane person who could. So you don't want to be able to visualize that, trust me. Now, space, it turns out, if space is light, space naturally bends away from itself into the shape of a saddle. And then there's the just right universe, the universe precariously balanced between the finite and the infinite. This is also a universe that was considered just right by theorists who try to understand the early evolution of the universe to explain essentially the Big Bang or the time just after the Big Bang. Those theorists always said that their theories to make the universe come out right would make the universe just right. The universe should be flat, as we say, which from our perspective means triangles add up to 180 degrees, seems like a very reasonable thing, and so the universe behaves, if it's just right, more or less as your intuition would tell you.
But of course the universe doesn't behave as you'd expect it to. You're listening to Professor Brian Schmidt, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics alongside fellow astrophysicists Saul Perlmutter and Adam Riess of the US. It's the first time since 1915 that an Australian has taken home the Nobel Prize for Physics. This is Big Ideas on RN, or you can podcast us via iTunes or our website at abc.net.au/Radio National, and you can follow us on Twitter at RN Big Ideas. So as the expansion of the universe accelerates, Brian Schmidt set out to prove whether gravity wins or loses the battle for the universe.
So in 1994, I knew I was coming to Australia, to a new land, and I figured I wanted to do something big. And the biggest thing I could think of was to figure the ultimate fate of the universe out. And so we concocted a plan to go through and measure the universe's past. So for my PhD thesis, I was able to measure how fast the universe was expanding now. Imagine I repeated that experiment, but to very, very distant objects, objects whose light has taken billions of years to reach us. Then I could see how the universe was changing over time, essentially measuring its trajectory. If the universe was expanding at the same rate in the past as now, well, that means the universe is coasting. It's an empty universe, which is infinite. On the other hand, if the universe was slowing down quickly on one side of this trajectory, then the universe would be finite. Gravity would eventually win, slow the universe down, and make it go into reverse. The other side of this trajectory, gravity loses, and the universe is light and infinite. So this experiment requires us to have an ability to measure distances a long, long ways away. And that was given to us by a particular type of object known as a Type 1a supernova. So to understand a Type 1a supernova, I want to take you through the evolution of an object like our sun. So our sun was born 4.6 billion years ago, and in about 5 billion years from now, it's going to puff up and eventually munch the Earth, and then eventually collapse down to a tiny little star called a white dwarf star. Now, if our sun instead were born as a binary, a close binary, that same process happens. The difference is that the star, its binary companion, would survive that process and be able to puff up and become a red giant and put material on that original first white dwarf, growing it in mass until it reaches 1.38 times the mass of our sun, at which point it becomes gravitationally unstable, something figured out by the astronomer Chandrasekhar, who won the Nobel Prize for that work, among other things, and the whole thing becomes a giant thermonuclear bomb, 5 billion times brighter than our sun. These objects rise and fall over a period of roughly 20 days, and as I said, they reach an incredible brightness of 5 billion times that of our own sun. So these objects were first understood by an astronomer, Fritz Zwicky, at Caltech, who used a telescope called a Schmidt telescope, not named after me or any of my relatives, to go out and take pictures of the sky and see how things change over time. And when he did this, he found these exploding stars. But the data was very poor, and the first ability to use them to make a Hubble diagram, that is a diagram like Hubble made that allowed us to plot distance versus redshift, happened in 1968. It's just like Hubble's diagram, but it goes out 100 times further than what Hubble was able to do. It turns out that's still 100 times not far enough to do the experiment we wanted to do, but it was the beginning. From this data, these supernovae got a reputation of being perfect, of being all exactly the same brightness, because quite frankly, it wasn't that the data showed this, it was just that the data were so poor that was consistent with that conclusion. It wasn't until a group in Chile called the Kalantololo Supernova Search went out and repeated what Zwicky did, but they were able to do it with digital technology, where they would go through and discover the supernovae exactly the same way that Zwicky did with photographic plates, but then follow them up with these new digital detectors called charge coupled devices, the same detectors that many people would have in their cameras and video cameras. And so that allowed precise measurements to be made. And when they did this work, they found a surprise. The supernovae were not all the same. But there was a pattern that allowed them to be rescued. And that pattern was that the faint objects rose and fell more quickly than the bright objects. In 1994, one of the group, Mario Hamwi, came up and visited me and my colleagues at Harvard, and he showed us their Hubble diagram. And their Hubble diagram, showing redshift versus distance, looks a little different. The points lie almost exactly on this line, rather than having a scatter. This showed that these supernovae could be used to measure distances with a precision of 6%. And for astronomers, that was an enormous improvement on anything we could do before that. This group eventually discovered 29 objects, and these have provided the fundamental basis of using these supernovae for measuring precise astronomical distances. In 1994, another breakthrough happened. A group led by Saul Perlmutter at Berkeley, who had been working since 1988 to discover distant exploding stars, finally achieved a breakthrough. And we found out about this at Harvard, where I was just a newly minted postdoc, when we were asked to go and look at a possible candidate. Now, we had got a chance to look at many candidates over the year, but they had all been fizzers in the previous years. This time when we made that measurement, we saw that they had discovered a distant type 1a supernova. We soon found out that this was one of seven that they had discovered. And the thing that had changed was that computers had gotten faster, but more importantly, the charge coupled devices had gotten bigger because supernovae are very rare objects. And to find them, you need to be able to map out a big piece of sky to find these very rare objects. In our own Milky Way, we have one of these objects every 200 to 500 years. And so you got to look at a lot of sky to have the chance to see one on any given day. And so in 1994, I was visiting Chile, and I had discussed with Saul Perlmutter the idea of using what the Chileans had learned in their program, but we had had some disagreements on exactly how to do that. It became very clear they had their own way of doing things. We had our own way of doing things. And so on that trip to Chile, I discussed and we formed a team to go through and essentially compete with Saul Perlmutter's group. And so the two teams, the Supernova Cosmology Project and the HiZ team, became very competitive The other thing that happened in 1994 was a new bit of technology. The Keck 10-meter telescopes came online. Before 1994, we did not have access to telescopes that would allow us to take spectra easily of these distant objects. We could only occasionally manage to get a glimpse of one of these distant objects. And so that technology, coupled with the advent of these large format charged couple devices, CCDs, which allowed us to take pictures of the sky almost as big as the full moon, not quite. These are 2,000 by 2,000 pixel, 4-megapixel chips. Now, 4-megapixel chips are about half of what you have in your iPhone today. But in 1994, those were huge. And you have to remember, in 1994, we had Pentium II 150 megahertz computers, and we had 1 gigabyte hard drives. And we would take this data, and we would take 50 gigabytes of data a night. And trying to manage that on my budget, I was a postdoc, I had $8,000 over 3 years to spend. That was the budget. So you don't always have to do big science to do interesting science. So the challenge was for me to find in this morass of data the objects. But just to fill you in on a little bit of technology that we're embarking on here in Australia, Australia has invested in the next generation of telescope. This is the giant Magellan telescope, made up of 7 8.36-meter mirrors. This telescope will be coming online hopefully at the end of the decade. So this telescope will allow us to look back further and farther than ever before, and it is the engine of discovery of the future, and I'm very glad to see that Australia is taking a leading role at this date in ensuring our ability to do astronomy into the future. The first of those 8.36-meter mirrors, which I got to see in person a couple months ago, it is polished to 19 nanometers. A nanometer is a billionth of a meter. That's just, you know, much, much finer than a hair. That whole 8.36-meter mirror has been polished already to its specification. All right, back to our story. The key is to find the exploding star, the needle in the haystack. So I was in charge of writing the software to do this. I'm okay at writing software, but, you know, it wasn't brilliant, I'm afraid. And as we said, we had slow computers and small disk drives. And so just to show you where the exploding star was, it is an object on the smudge on the side of this galaxy. And the reason we were able to find it is we take not one image, but two images. And so by digitally aligning the data and then warping the data so it looks exactly like the first image, you can then subtract the images and see what appears. And in this case, nothing on the 4th of April becomes an object that we discovered 24 days later. This object, 5 billion light years in distance, exploded before the Earth was formed. So that is the power that we have at our disposal in cosmology. We can look back in time. Now, we only get 6 nights a year because we're competing with every other astronomer in the world for this telescope time. And so we are making sure that we point the telescope exactly where it should. All the images are perfect. And then we set my software on it to go through and find the objects. Of course, it finds lots of stuff, most of which is junk. And so we have a veritable sweatshop of people peering through the data, trying to figure out the things my software has popped up are real or are not interesting. And time is of the essence, because we need to get the data and the targets across the globe to the Keck telescope within 36 hours, where we have more scheduled time on these largest of telescopes. So, the end of 1997, Adam Rees sent me a plot of his first run through the data. This plot, we see each supernova plotted as a bar, because the supernovae, remember, give an uncertainty. The nearby objects essentially provide no discrimination between the types of things we're looking at. But when we look at the distant objects, you can see that every single one of those objects lies above the line where the universe is finite. That is, that the universe is not, unfortunately, from my perspective at the time, going to end. I always had this secret desire to have the universe have an end since it had a beginning. But I've learned that the universe does what it wants, and it's my job just to go through and observe it, not to pass judgment. More concerning to me in the end of 1997 was that the objects on average did not lie in the part of the diagram where the universe was slowing down. Instead, they lie above that coasting line where the universe is speeding up. The analysis that we did at the time said that it was only a 1 in 10,000 chance that the universe could be slowing down from this data. The other surprise to us at the time was that the other team was working on this same project. And people often ask both teams, did you have a eureka moment? In our case, when we first saw the data, my initial response was not, whoopee, it was, oh my, what have we done wrong? And so it was really through a very long process of going through and making sure that each part of the project was done correctly that we had the realization that the universe seemed to be speeding up. Much to our surprise when we got this answer is the other team was getting exactly the same answer to us. And this led to two papers published in 1998 by the two teams seeing almost an identical behavior of the universe. The universe speeding up over time. Now, when you win a Nobel Prize, interesting things happen to you. For me, I got taken off the airplane when we landed in Stockholm, and I was presented with a BMW and a driver. And the driver came up and said, hello, my name is Stig. And I said, Stig? Well, Stig drove us around the streets of Stockholm very quickly in the BMW. You get to meet the king of Sweden. And in this case, the Swedes always wanted to know, what does the king tell you? Well, in my case, the king said, congratulations on the Nobel Prize in Physics, and thank you very much for the bottle of wine. Because I'm a winemaker in addition to being an astronomer, and so I decided I should give the bottle of wine that I had made to the king, and I guess the king had already sampled it by the time I had met him, which was, I guess, nice. The other thing they give you is a princess. Princess Victoria. And so I got to escort her down, and as I saw this picture, I told my wife, I said, I look so glamorous with a princess on my arm. My wife was not impressed with that statement. All right, so let's get back to what is pushing on the universe. What would make the universe accelerate? Well, we only have to look to Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein's greatest blunder appears to be our great discovery. If you have energy, part of space, the cosmological constant, it can exactly reproduce our results. Now, we're not sure that Albert Einstein's version of this is correct, so we give it a generic name. That generic name is dark energy. So, when we made this measurement, of course, people were questioning it, and our detailed analysis showed that the universe was a mix of about 30% gravitating matter, pulling on the universe, and 70% of this stuff pushing on the universe. That balance is what reproduce our observations. So one of the first groups to be able to test our result in detail was a group led here in Australia by Matthew Collis using this map of 221,000 galaxies, the 2DF Redshift Survey. So this map of galaxies allowed them to go through and see the motions of galaxies with respect to each other. And those motions are induced by gravitational attraction. And in this way, they could weigh the universe very, very precisely. And in 2001, when they were first able to make this measurement, they found that the amount of gravity pulling on the galaxies accounted for 27% of the amount of stuff needed to make the universe flat. That's how we account for things as astronomers. We measure things relative to the amount of material to make the universe flat. And so that was an interesting number, but it was also an interesting number because it made very clear the long-term problem that there always seemed to be more gravity than there were atoms. In this case, this fine measurement showed that there was 5 times more gravity than there were atoms to account for that attraction. And so that leads to our next dark sector object, dark matter. Dark matter. Well, you can notice that whenever we don't understand things, we give the term dark in astronomy. It's sort of a euphemism for we don't understand for astronomers. So dark matter could be some undiscovered particle that, for example, like a neutrino, can pass right through the Earth. And so because it doesn't interact with anything, it's almost impossible to see. Yet it has gravity, just like atoms, but is essentially invisible. Now, the discovery of what appears to be something like a Higgs boson may be giving us a hint of other particles, one of which could be this particle. We don't know yet. There is some hope that possibly in the next 6 months we'll get some more clues to what dark matter is. But it's a hope. We could be left high and dry with no further explanation. That is sometimes the way science works. The other experiment that came around was that of the cosmic microwave background. That image of the early universe shows sound waves splashing around the universe. And the physics of those sound waves is very well understood. It's the same type of physics we have here on Earth. And physics tells us those sound waves are 450,000 light years long. And remember that a ruler, the further away it is, the smaller it appears. So we can use that effect with another effect, which is the size of a ruler depends not just on how far away it is, it depends on the curvature of space. And so if you have a universe which is curved, objects appear different sizes. So a ruler laid down on 2 different types of universes shows that in a closed universe, you see a smaller part of the ruler than in the flat universe. Or in other words, objects appear larger in curved finite space, not unlike your rearview mirror, which distorts the appearance of things. So by looking at how big these sound waves are in the early universe, we can judge the geometry of space. And when we do this, we get a very precise measurement of the geometry of space, which is the universe has 100% plus or minus 1% of the amount of matter to make the universe be flat. The difference with this experiment is sensitive to all forms of matter. Matter that makes gravity push or pull both add up into this experiment. The experiment done with galaxies was only sensitive to material that made gravity attract. So if we put this together and then subtract, we have 100% of all matter, 27% of which is gravitationally attractive matter, leaving us with 73% mystery matter, that same mystery matter that the supernovae showed was pushing the universe apart. So we put this all together, and what do we have? Well, we unfortunately have a little bit of a mess. We have a universe which is 4.5% atoms. Those are the things we know about in the universe, the stuff we can see. The rest of the stuff is stuff that's invisible. 24% dark matter, 72% dark energy. And so you might think, looking at a universe where we only know 4.5% of it, 95.5% of it is a mystery, you might well think that we just don't know what we're doing. And that would be a reasonable view, except science is all about prediction. And this mess predicts very, very well what we see. We have done test after test after test in the last 13 years. And every time this model predicts something, we go out and measure it, and it gets it exactly right. And that's what science is all about. It's not about elegance, it's about prediction. And so we think things are right as long as they give the right answer. And so there is a philosophical view, is what is reality? Well, from a science point of view, reality is what predicts what we see. And so it may well be that this mess is eventually overturned with a bigger and better theory. But my guess is, whatever that theory is, it will look a lot like what we are seeing today. because it is so good at predicting what we do see. So dark matter, as the universe expands, the amount of dark matter and atoms stays the same. And so the density and gravitational effect of the dark matter gets smaller over time as the universe expands, because the density of material gets smaller. Dark energy, on the other hand, is tied to space itself. As the universe expands, dark energy gets created with the created space, and so it becomes stronger relative to dark matter over time. So if you look back in time, the opposite things happens. You make a piece of space smaller, then the amount of dark energy is smaller in the box, whereas the density of normal material like atoms rises. So back in time, the effect of gravity pulling will be larger than the effect of dark energy's pushing. So you really have a battle for domination of the universe between dark energy and dark matter. If you go back and look far enough in time, the universe will be denser and denser and denser with normal atoms and dark matter. So gravitational attraction will be larger and larger back in time. If we look back far enough in time, we should see the time when dark matter was dominating the universe and causing the universe to slow down. And this is something we could do with the most distant supernovae that we can detect. That object was the first of several objects that Adam Riess was able to use the Hubble Space Telescope to go back and really see what the universe was doing back further and further in time. And his data shows that the universe, back to about 6 billion years ago, was accelerating, and then it turned a corner where it started decelerating about 6 billion years ago. And so the supernova showed that indeed this measurement that we expected, we passed the test with this measurement. The universe has gone through a period where it was dominated by stuff we know, and has only recently, about 6 billion years ago, become dominated by this dark energy. And so what is the future of the universe then? Well, the future of the universe seems to be dark energy, because once dark energy takes over, it causes space to expand, creating more dark energy, which is part of space itself, which can then push harder against gravity, creating even more space, creating more dark energy, pushing the universe harder. You get a runaway process. The creation of space eventually can happen even more quickly than light can travel. So imagine a galaxy, a photon coming towards us through this rapidly expanding universe. That photon will be traveling and literally get stranded in the creation of space between us and the distant galaxy. This leads to an interesting future for people like myself who are cosmologists. Our part of the universe is not expanding. Our part of the universe collapsed 13 billion years ago, and so this part of the universe is very dense. It is 30 orders of magnitude more dense than dark energy. Dark energy cannot get its foot in the door and start expanding this part of the universe. So our part of the universe is sitting still. However, the distant galaxies that are not within our gravitationally bound area will get pushed further and further apart from us by this dark energy over time. The nearest galaxies to us, the Andromeda spiral is infalling to us right now, and a few other galaxies will form a super galaxy in the future. And you can see that in about 3 billion years, we expect the Andromeda spiral to come in and merge with our Milky Way. And it's not going to be a train wreck because there's lots of space between stars. It's like two swarms of bees merging. And so in the future, we're going to live in a very different Milky Way. But we will look out to a universe where all the galaxies become further and further away, and eventually their light cannot reach us. So we will live in an island universe of stars, but with the rest of the universe accelerated out of sight. And when the rest of the universe is accelerated out of sight, cosmologists such as myself, who study galaxies, will be unemployed because there will be nothing left for us to do. We will see stars, but look out into an empty universe. So I'm already started hedging my bets. I'm working in planets and stars rather than just cosmology now, to make sure I don't run out of anything to do. All right. The reality is, until we understand what's accelerating the cosmos, anything is actually possible. This dark energy might change in the future. Einstein says it doesn't change ever, but Einstein's version may not be exactly right. So the universe could slow down or even accelerate faster in the future. Now, that leads to one of the craziest theoretical ideas, something called the Big Rip. But I will say, although it's crazy, it's one of my favorite. The idea is that if dark energy gets created more quickly than the creation of space, that is, if I take a piece of space and I double it and I create more than twice the amount of dark energy, so you're actually increasing the density of dark energy over time, dark energy is able to reach into all the parts of the universe that had already collapsed, including our galaxy, the Milky Way, our planet, the Earth, and eventually even our atoms. This is a universe that on literally a human time scale, you will see the stars in the sky start disappearing as they're accelerated beyond the speed of light to get us. Then one day, the sun will go out. And then, not too long after, you and the Earth will be ripped into pieces with all of your atoms and even your atoms being spread out into the fundamental particles. A very exciting universe which ends up with the whole universe expanding, isolated, every piece of the universe isolated from every other part of the universe, but having effectively infinite density in the future. And the reason I like this is that starts you or ends you with a universe that looks a lot like the universe that begins, an infinitely dense, expanding blob of stuff. Now, no one's really calculated formally what happens there, and this is an extremely, a theoretical idea, probably not the way the universe is, but at least gives me hope. Anyway, this would certainly leave nothing or possibly something to begin again. Either way, I think if we look out into the universe, unless dark energy suddenly disappears very quickly, the universe will, at an ever-increasing rate, expand and fade away. And I'll stop there.
Australia's 2011 Nobel Laureate for Physics, Professor Brian Schmidt, with last year's Alison Levick Memorial Lecture, presented by the Australian Astronomical Observatory. Brian Schmidt is Laureate Fellow at the Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the Australian National University. He's continuing his work using exploding stars to study the universe, and also at the Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the ANU, he's leading the effort to build the SkyMapper telescope.